Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Rebecca Martinez.
And I'm Willow Belden. Last night, candidates for U.S. House and Senate gathered in Riverton for a set of debates. They answered questions ranging from how to address the Medicare shortfall to their views on climate change and the energy industry. Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck was one of the moderators, and he joins us from Riverton to talk about the debate. So first of all, was there anything new that we learned about the candidates last night, things we hadn't heard them say before?
I'm not so sure we learned anything new. I thought it was sort of interesting on the House side of things that Representative Lummis, perhaps because of some of the maybe more conservative folks that were off the panel, she went a little more conservative. You heard her talking maybe a little bit more. Not that she hasn't talked about budget cuts in the past, but you heard him be a little more aggressive, the kinds of things that she would, in fact, cut, what she's very cautious about spending in the future. And I did think that you heard both Senator Barrasso and Representative Lummis point out that everything's on the table. Whether it would be funding, obviously, for public radio to many, many other cuts. I think Senator Barrasso expressed some concern about the Department of Education, wanting things done much more locally. So we heard him talk about that maybe a little bit in the past, but perhaps in a little more great detail. And you did get the impression that Senator Barrasso and Representative Lummis, should they get reelected, they're going to be the kinds of people who are very willing to really do a lot of cuts and are not going to be willing at all to be looking at any revenue increases, such as anything to do with taxes.
And of course, we had several third-party candidates in the debate, particularly the debate for U.S. House. We had a candidate from the Constitution Party, one from the Country Party, one from the Libertarian Party. And these third-party candidates all had fairly similar views on a lot of things. Why were they all running on separate tickets?
Well, what's interesting about this is they need to run and get enough support on the ballot in order to get their parties eligible for the next election. So if they get, I think it's 2% support, they'll all have an opportunity to get on legislative ballots. They'll have a chance to run for some other offices in the state. Now, why is that so important to them? Apparently, the Country Party thinks the Libertarians are just a little too liberal, a little too out there for them, because they have some concerns about some of their views. They also have some concerns about the Constitution Party. And so I think the Country Party sees themselves as the most conservative of the bunch, and so they believe that they're necessary. The Libertarian Party has been a longtime party in our state, but there are some values that they have that apparently the Constitution Party doesn't share. So that's the reason you see so many of them, because there is going to be an effort, and we're seeing it this year, to get these guys on the ballot so they don't have to go out and get signatures all the time in the future.
Let's shift to talking about the Democrats for a little bit. Obviously, the Democratic candidates for House and Senate have been operating on shoestring budgets. It's made it hard for them to get their views out there to voters. And these debates kind of give them a chance to make their case. How effective were they at doing that in this debate?
I thought Tim Chestnut really did a pretty darn good job in the U.S. Senate side of things. It was it's tough. He doesn't have any money. He's I think he spent $1,000, and he's been a county commissioner who, frankly, didn't spend a lot of money. But he was able to, get some viewpoints out, certainly express some opinions, such as I was impressed with his answer on not cutting science research money, as an example, which Senator Barrasso did support last night. That might have been something we hadn't heard before. But Commissioner Chestnut, I thought, did a nice job of explaining why you might want to not touch that kind of money. So that was interesting. I also thought Chris Hendrickson did a good job. He had a tough night because you had four people very conservative on that panel, and so he had to really make his case. And I thought at the end of the day, he did express his viewpoint. This is a very smart individual, a very good candidate. But again, it's just so darn tough for them to score and do very well in a debate like that when everybody really does have a conservative viewpoint that truthfully is shared by the majority of Wyoming. And, did he do what he needed to do to win that election? Probably not, because I think most of the people in the state were more focused on some of the conservative viewpoints. But I thought he did make his case, and I think in a perfect world, if he has enough money, if he could go head-to-head with Representative Lummis and maybe has some legislative background in the future. I think he's a guy that really could be a very effective candidate in the future. But for his first shot, I thought he did fine, and I also thought Tim Chestnut did fine. And I also, for the most part, thought if you're conservative – and you're looking for something out of the mainstream, I thought the third-party candidates represented very well. We've seen some people in the past that you kind of wonder where they came from, and you might have wondered that if you didn't agree with this point of view of some of those folks. But, you know, they made their case, and they presented a good, solid argument for the way they see the world. And so I thought it was a very informative debate, if anything else.
I want to shift focus away from the debates last night for a little bit and talk about some of the constitutional amendments that are on the ballot this year. Can you give us a brief overview of what those amendments are?
Yeah, let me start at the bottom. Constitutional Amendment C, probably not a big deal. What this would allow is giving some of your court commissioners, these are the types of people that help judges, it gives them a little more power. Now, truthfully, what most of the district court judges have said is this is going to give these people the same kind of power that they have right now, but it's not necessarily spelled out in the Constitution that they can do some of the extra things they're doing now. And so the Supreme Court and the district courts are pushing very hard for the passage of this so they can allow these court commissioners to act on some juvenile cases that do have a time deadline when a district court judge is busy. And so that's one for people to decide philosophically on whether or not you think that's a good idea. Amendment B is basically putting in our Constitution the right to hunt. Now, why is that important? There is some concern by those who are very interested in hunting that at some point in time that might be outlawed, or there might be some gun laws that would make that difficult, whatever the concern might be. So they're pushing very hard to get this passed, not a very controversial one at all. I think the only negative I've ever heard to it is it maybe raises this type of recreation above cross-country skiing or something else that you might do. Maybe we need to put cross-country skiing in the Constitution or snowmobiling, I don't know. But that's what they're after here. I think the one that people are taking a long look at is Constitutional Amendment A. And what that would do, and I don't have the wording right in front of me, but it's a health care constitutional amendment. And it basically is intended to allow people in the state to not be forced to follow the Affordable Care Act. And so this was in response to what the Republicans like to call Obamacare. And that was 2 years ago when this was put on the ballot, and we had a very conservative legislative session that year. It's got some interesting wording in it, and one of the things that does have some people concerned is while it says maybe the federal government doesn't have a lot of power over an individual's health care in Wyoming, it does give the state of Wyoming a lot of power. And that is specifically spelled out in this constitutional amendment. And so if you're somebody who doesn't want government involved in your health care much at all, truthfully, you probably aren't going to like this constitutional amendment. It does give the state a lot of power, but takes the power away from the federal government. So it's an interesting thing that you would consider putting in your constitution. And if you should scrutinize these amendments certainly all the time, because putting things in the constitution is very important. But I know there are people that have specifically circled Constitutional Amendment A as one to maybe take a very close look at.
All right, Bob Beck talking with us about last night's congressional debates and also about constitutional amendments that are on the ballot this year. Thanks, Bob.
Thank you very much.
Wyoming votes overwhelmingly Republican. Republicans have held a majority in the state Senate continuously since 1936 and in the state House since 1964. But the upcoming general election has exposed a rift inside the party challenging its unity, especially where primary losers have mounted write-in campaigns. David Cook of the Bighorn Radio Network reports on one of three write-in campaigns for the state's legislative body.
In Park County, there are 13,419 registered voters. 93% of voters are registered as Republican. However, within the party, there are many different views on what it means to be a Republican. Some of those views are so different, in fact, it has caused a rift within the party, challenging their unity.
I view the Park County Republican Party as a very hardworking group of people, and I think that they have recently been challenged in terms of their unity, and I think they have learned from some lessons that over-unity can sometimes not be the best.
That is City of Cody Mayor Nancy Tia Brown. I spoke with her at a recent GOP-sponsored meet and greet. The challenge Mayor Brown refers to is nowhere more visible than in the race for Senate District 18. In that race, longtime incumbent Senator Hank Coe narrowly beat his challenger Bob Berry by 117 votes. Dissatisfied with the results, Berry has since launched a write-in campaign. Coe's roots run deep in the community, dating back to 1909 when Cody was incorporated. Berry moved to the area from Texas in 2001 and has been instrumental in the founding of the Bighorn Basin Tea Party, whose majority of members are not satisfied with Coe or, moreover, the direction of the party in Wyoming, as expressed here by write-in candidate Bob Berry.
We would like to see the Republic flourish again. It needs to start in Wyoming. We need a voice in Cheyenne that expresses our innate freedom as Wyomingites, that says we can, not a voice that declares that we can't because the federal government mandates this or that. I came into this race as a conservative Republican, and I remained in this race as a conservative Republican, albeit not the nominee. One sage comment has been made here in Cody over and over. You get what you vote for. Truer words have never been spoken.
For his part, Senator Coe points out he already beat Berry once.
Clearly, the primary process has already taken place, and I was the winner of the primary, and I would hope that people would respect that process and not support the same candidate that loses to me in the primary with a write-in campaign. I'm the Republican nominee. I've got a certificate of nomination from the Secretary of State's office to be on the general election ballot. And I would hope that the people and the voters would see that and would support me as the Republican nominee.
The situation is not unique to Park County. There are three write-in campaigns in Wyoming where primary losers refuse to quit. The issue has become so intense that Governor Meade has weighed in.
You know, if you're a Republican, to me, you sort of live or die with the primary. I mean, if you believe in the conservative values of the Republican Party, you run in. And, you know, traditionally what is done after a Republican primary is if you lose, you get on the phone right away and provide support to the winner.
Will the winners and losers of the upcoming general election be satisfied with the final results? Will the tent of the Republican Party in Park County and, moreover, Wyoming expand or retract? Will those who believe that Wyoming Republicans are not conservative enough launch a viable alternative? Just as we wait to learn the results of the election itself, we will have to wait to learn the answer to those questions as well. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm David Cook in Cody.
Back, we'll learn about why Wyoming is such a red state, and we'll hear commentary from historian Phil Roberts about the days before the state was so solidly Republican. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Rebecca Martinez. Polls show that nearly 57% of Wyomingites identify as Republicans, making the state one of the reddest in the nation. Wyoming Public Radio's Willow Belden explores why that's the case and what it means to be so red.
There's little doubt that Wyoming will vote for Mitt Romney for president, reelect both Republican members of Congress who are running this year, and maintain a solidly Republican state legislature. Political scientist Jim King says the state is so solidly Republican because Wyomingites tend to mistrust the federal government. They don't want government intrusion, and they don't feel they need help from the government.
You don't need the same, for example, support for transportation infrastructure. Yes, you have to have lots of roads, but you don't need highways crisscrossing themselves in the West as you do in some of the northeastern states.
Many Wyomingites also live in such remote areas that they don't have access to many government services.
You don't have somebody, a government that's providing trash service to you. You don't have other programs such as, you know, a Parks and Recreation Department. So I think if you live in an area where the public services aren't as obvious, then you tend to develop a favoritism towards the party that is speaking to the smaller government argument.
Representative Joe Barbuto, one of the few Democrats in the Wyoming House, takes it a step further. He says it's not just that Wyomingites feel they don't need government. They also think government, especially with Democrats in charge, gets in the way of their livelihood by creating too many regulations and too much red tape.
Wyoming Democrats are victim of this perception that Democrats are anti-energy, anti-agriculture, and those things just aren't true, but that's the perception that's out there.
Still, just because Wyoming has a larger percentage of Republicans than most other states, that doesn't mean those Republicans are more conservative than Republicans elsewhere. Samuel Western is a writer who specializes in Wyoming history. He says Wyomingites tend to be more libertarian and less ideologically conservative.
Wyoming was just horrified when Matthew Shepard was killed. So I think we're more laissez-faire than most red states on the social issues.
That includes issues like abortion. Some of Wyoming's staunchest conservatives are pro-choice because they don't feel government should meddle in personal decisions. As a result, Western says legislation with a social agenda rarely passes in the state legislature. Mentalities do seem to be shifting, though. In the primaries this year, several incumbent state legislators faced serious challenges from ultra-conservative and Tea Party opponents. Senator Hank Coe of Cody is one of those incumbents. He beat his Tea Party challenger by only a narrow margin, and he says voters across the state are leaning farther right than in the past.
We probably are getting a little more conservative, most of it due to the things like Obamacare that's being rammed down our throat by the feds, just for example, and I think there's just huge opposition to that in this state, and I think that will continue.
Wyoming wasn't always so staunchly Republican. Historian Phil Roberts says that for many years, the state was fairly evenly split.
During the New Deal, Wyoming had a congressional delegation that was entirely Democratic for the good part of the 1930s. And then up until 1976, there was at least one member of the congressional delegation that was a Democrat.
That's because in those days, large numbers of unionized railroad workers lived in southern Wyoming and tended to vote Democratic. But as technology evolved and diesel locomotives replaced coal-fired engines, fewer railroad workers were needed and support for the Democratic Party dwindled. Moving forward, most agree that Wyoming will continue to be a red state. But just how red isn't clear. Again, Samuel Western.
Wyoming is getting older. And, you know, as we age, there are an increasing number of people who are going to need the help of the federal government, mostly on Medicaid and Medicare. And they are going to need senior citizen centers and transportation and better hospitals, all of which the government has been directly or indirectly involved in.
Western says the need for those types of services could make people more receptive to Democrats in the future. Representative Joe Barbuto says there's another reason the state might become less solidly Republican.
You know, a lot of people talk about the need for economic diversification, and I think if we did have that economic diversification, we'd have different industries, different businesses here. And those would bring in different folks who might have a different political viewpoint than others. And I think that we'll see more Democrats in the legislature in the years to come.
And he says that would be a good thing because political diversity creates the kind of robust discussions that keep democracies healthy. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Willow Belden.
Now we'll take a look at the evolution of the blue influence in such a red state. University of Wyoming history professor Phil Roberts says Wyoming's Democratic Party lost many of its constituents when the state lost its large railroad and mining labor unions. But the party also failed to make up for that loss by not painting itself as the party for the modern cowboy.
The Democrats, at least the power of the Democratic Party in Wyoming, throughout most of the 20th century had to do with the majority of residents in the southern counties, that is the UP counties that we used to call them, Laramie, Albany, Carbon, Sweetwater, and Uinta County. And so it was very solidly railroad labor oriented, all these counties along the southern tier. As the New Deal was getting underway, those unions became very much a significant part of the Democratic Party's influence. Then in the northern tier of counties, in those first 70 years or so of statehood, the main interests were cattle and agriculture. Primarily, the northern tier of counties were Republican and agricultural in their orientation, and not the populist kind of agriculturalists, but mostly people involved in ranching rather than in crop agriculture. And then in the middle, you have this these three counties that are pretty much, or at least in the early days, were more or less the swing counties. And then, of course, along came technological change, and along came the diesel locomotive in the 1950s. And gradually, over the next decade after the 50s, a lot of those coal mines closed down, because they were producing coal primarily for locomotion, for those locomotives, which the diesels, you could do the same thing with, say, two or three railroad workers on one train that you could have a generation earlier with 12 to 14 people. When the new boom came in coal in 1973, 74, 75, it became very much an automated industry. Sort of like diesel locomotives in a way, because you could operate a strip mine with very, very few employees. You didn't have to have the same kind of workforce that you had with an underground mine with only very minimal kinds of automation. And so that cut out a substantial part of the population that was more or less the labor population that you had here. I think what the Democratic Party has been victimized by is their inability to capture the symbols in Wyoming. And what I mean by that is that the Republicans have been pretty shrewd about defining what a cowboy was back in the mythical days of the open range. And they've defined him as obviously a white guy that is probably from Texas, who probably has particular attitudes about rugged individualism and various aspects that sort of embody the Republican ideology, whereas Democrats have pretty much ceded the territory rather than to argue the fact that, indeed, cowboys on the open range illustrate a lot of the principles of the Democratic Party, and that here's a laboring guy who is up against some pretty formidable forces. You know, he's at the mercy of the outfit. It was not always the case that the cowboys ever got a fair shake from the big outfit. So I think what happens, even with such simple things as the bucking horse on the license plate, hey, that was put on the license plate by a Democrat. And it's just those little things like that that suggest to me that the Democratic Party has ceded a lot of those symbolic opportunities.
When we come back, we'll hear what Affordable Care Act benefits have riding on Tuesday's election, and we'll learn about the difference new medical technology is making in rural hospitals. This is Open Spaces.
Back to Open Spaces. I'm Rebecca Martinez.
And I'm Willow Belden. Earlier this year, Wyoming learned that its share of abandoned mine land money was cut in a congressional conference committee. Estimates are that it will cost Wyoming over $700 million, and Governor Meade says the cut hurts as the state will have to find new ways to pay for construction or other one-time projects. Wyoming author and Wyophile contributor Samuel Western recently wrote about the cut. He joins Bob Beck to discuss it.
Sam, it's interesting, this article that you wrote for Wildfile. I think one of the things that I got out of this is maybe that the Wyoming delegation shouldn't have been overly surprised that the AML money was stripped away.
I would agree, Bob. And, you know, this AML situation puts our Washington-based delegation in a tough position because historically a Washington delegation has been appreciated for what they bring back to a state or funds that they protect for a state. And so here is our Congress who is liberating funds from the Abandoned Mine Reclamation Fund. And it's Senator Enzi and Barrasso and Representative Loomis' job to protect that. But I think the political reality is that is low-hanging fruit, and Congress is going to take that when they think they need to.
Representative Loomis was telling me that an article that appeared in a national publication probably didn't help Wyoming because it called attention to the fact that some of the AML money spent by the legislature this year was going to buildings. Obviously, the big one that seemed to catch everybody's attention was the, I think, $10 million that was going for the arena auditorium upgrade. It seemed to me that the legislature at times maybe forgot that somebody might be paying attention to how they're spending that money.
Oh, I would agree. And in all deference to Representative Loomis, there are a lot of people, especially in Pennsylvania, Representative Nick Rahal from West Virginia, they're keeping a very close eye on where the money goes in Wyoming. It's the transparency is pretty profound. So.
You actually spent a little time in state government. Was there always the opinion that that money could be used for just about anything?
Oh, I would be pretty careful in qualifying that statement. There are so many funding mechanisms, and some of those funding mechanisms have definite qualifiers on them. But Abandoned Mine Reclamation Fund, the scope just broadened and broadened. As some of our listeners may know, this was it was originally this trust fund was occurred because the Surface Mine Reclamation Act was passed in 1977, and this was a funding mechanism to reclaim coal mines, which was part of SMACRA, as we called it. And SMACRA has been reauthorized, I think, six times. And it's always sort of been under the radar. It's never been a big deal. And but we just haven't had the budget crises that we've had now. So.
Wyoming's delegation and governors in the past have always argued this is Wyoming's money. This is not something that anybody can take away from them. What's your read on that?
2 points. One, it's not necessarily Wyoming's money. The Abandoned Mine Reclamation Trust Fund was funded by a 35-cent per ton tax on strip mines and a 15-cent per ton tax on underground mine. Now, as in most cases, taxes are passed on to the customer. So who really put that money into the Abandoned Mine Reclamation Fund was the buyers of Wyoming coal. Therefore, that would be the people of Missouri or Arkansas, whoever's burning Powder River Basin or Hanna coal, that put the money in, not the people of Wyoming. So I'm not really sure it's our money. And the second point is Congress gets to change its mind. That's sort of a fact of life. And I would qualify that we're proprietary about this money.
Sam, what does strike me as very interesting in this is you have two members of Congress from Wyoming that are running for reelection. And, okay, we need to balance the budget, but normally they wait for the election cycle to get over with before they would do something like this. Did that catch you by surprise as well?
Not really. Well, yes and no. I get the sense there is so much pressure right now on all members of Congress to do something about the budget or, you know, this financial cliff that we're talking about, that I think that people will be, if you will, impolitic, our representatives, because ordinarily they would wait till after the election before doing something like this. But, plus pressure on all members of Congress to have unity. When Paul Ryan says, this is our budget, our Wyoming delegation said, yes, it is our budget, even though the budget proposed by Representative Ryan, if it had passed, would have stripped all money from Wyoming.
But what's so crazy about this, though, is you do have a member on this committee that didn't have any in Representative Loomis that was not able to stop this from happening.
No, No, and I don't think – I think you could have been, I mean, I'm the most powerful member of any committee, and maybe that's too much of a sweeping statement, but there are forces that are just at play that are going to make it really tough for those lone voices to say, hey, wait a minute, wait. I mean, because you're going to have to negotiate some sort of deal. What can you give this other person to get back? And Wyoming's in a tough corner.
What does this tell us as we look to the future? We look at budget cuts. We look at balancing the budget. I mean, or is there something that Wyoming should be paying attention to here?
Yes, if I could put it in a single term. One third of all the proposed budget cuts are going to affect states and political subdivisions. They're going to affect housing, the whole ball of wax. And I think the big picture is that Wyoming can expect a lot less money from Washington in the next 10 years. How much? Don't know. You know, but I think business as usual. I think we were very lucky to get, you know, when the transportation bill was passed on June 29th of this year, I think Wyoming was very lucky to get $750 million for that three-year appropriation. We got a great deal. So,
and we've always had a pretty good deal when you look at Homeland Security and things like that.
Bob, Wyoming has had a great deal from Washington. And I somehow would like more people to put that in perspective, is that we've really – Washington, though we don't like them very much, they've given us billions. You know,
Sam Western wrote about the AML funds in WyoFile. It's at WyoFile.com, and you can always follow Sam there. Sam, always a pleasure chatting with you. Thanks so much for stopping in.
The pleasure's all mine, Bob. Thanks.
The fate of the Affordable Care Act has been a sticking point for both presidential candidates. Mitt Romney has said he intends to repeal it, while President Obama has vowed to protect the promises it makes to reform parts of the health care system. Dr. Lewis Hoheiser, CEO of St. John's Medical Center, has studied the ACA closely, and he says the law is already breaking down barriers, especially for women.
Barriers in terms of copays for mammograms, copays for your routine checkups like pap smears, et cetera. And Affordable Care Act says that those copays go away.
I was going to ask how much of a difference that's likely to make. I mean, are the people who are likely to get that sort of just willing to accept that cost, or is it really the difference of somebody getting one of those treatments?
It's dependent upon their individual policy. But for instance, you know, a mammogram, someone might have a $150 or $200 copay. And there's a huge range in this. In tough times, when they're making choices of paying their bills or having food for the kids, they might say, I'm not getting my mammogram this year. So, yes, it can make a significant difference that way.
How much of a difference can it make if you make the decision to get a mammogram now or put it off a year, or a pap smear now and put it off a year?
If you talk about this on a population basis, very little difference. If you talk about this for the individual woman who you might pick up an abnormality, it could be life-saving. And that's what people don't understand, that when people are trying to make decisions based on national policy, it may not make sense to spend a lot of money on something, say the mammogram, on a yearly basis. On the other hand, for an individual woman, it would make a difference.
You know, there's a lot of talk about what will happen, you know, sort of hinging on this presidential election. It's sort of assumed that if President Obama is reelected, the Affordable Care Act will go forward as it's written. But there's talk of repeal or executive orders that might implement, you know, changes and cut a lot of this stuff. How much of a difference could, you know, either decision or either tack make in the health of women?
Quite frankly, I think the talk about the changes and the impact on the individuals are political rather than reality. I think that most of the insurers have already decided that they're keeping this part of the program no matter what the law says. So if the law was repealed, I expect kids to stay on their parents' policy up to age 26. I expect that there's not going to be pre-existing conditions, as long as the playing field is level for all insurance companies. And I expect many of these preventive measures to stay the way they are because people have planned on it already. It's already being implemented. Now, the whole healthcare system, the way it's organized under the Accountable Care Organization, I think there could be dramatic changes on that from the program as a whole. But in these individual situations, I don't think there's going to be a major shift, no matter which party's in.
Interesting. You're saying that regardless of what happens, you're expecting insurers to basically volunteer to keep these guidelines that are set by the current manifestation of the Affordable Care Act. Is that because, you know, you think that they know that that's what their customers want, or why not, you know, go back on their plans, their promises?
A lot of people don't believe that insurance companies really want to do the right thing for people, but they do. They need to make money at the same time. So I think they figured out these are the right things to do at this point. They've already built it into their cost structure, and it's not as if they're giving it away. People are still going to be charged for this. As it becomes part of your total cost to your policy versus you're paying individually at the time you go get your mammogram. But if people imagine that this stuff becomes free, you know, Rebecca, there is no free lunch. We're all going to pay for it somehow.
Thank you so much, sir. I appreciate your time.
You're welcome, Rebecca. You can call back anytime you want. Bye-bye.
Louis Hoheiser is the CEO of St. John's Medical Center in Jackson.
Figuring out cost-effective ways to upgrade rural health care is the goal of all hospitals and medical providers in the state. But it's especially tough for the smallest rural facilities. The number of doctors are small, which can lead to mistakes, and specialists are at a premium. But thanks to electronic records and other forms of telemedicine, things are starting to improve. Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck reports.
This is Platte Valley Community Hospital in Wheatland. The hospital is owned by Banner Health, one of the leaders in the effort to get electronic medicine into rural areas. Inside a nearby room sits the hospital's informatics coordinator, Deborah Lockman. Lockman types in information that could be part of a massive electronics record system that has changed the way they do business. If you are a lot like a lot of us in Wyoming, you get used to repeating your medical histories over and over. And because of that, mistakes are made. Under their system, those records are stored on a computer and can be accessed by other providers if needed.
It helps when the patients come in, their histories carry over, their allergies carry over. However, at the same time, we confirm that information.
Medical errors have been a part of healthcare for many years. But under this system, Lockman says errors are reduced. For one thing, nurses and others have a better idea of what a doctor wants.
The physicians enter their orders. That eliminates that need to interpret that handwriting. There are several safety features that come from that. There are alerts that alert the physician while they're writing their orders.
In other words, if a physician starts to make a diagnosis, the computer alerts the doctor to check some specific things and even asks the doctor to double-check things. Then, if they prescribe the wrong medication, they'll also get an alert. Pharmacist David Burke says they have a similar system that helps them make sure that a prescription fits the patient's needs, and it also checks to see they're getting the right amount.
It's eliminated a lot of errors or potential errors. There's no deciding whether that's an L or that's a 50 or that's a 500. There's checks and balances that you didn't used to be. The human side or the human error potential is really diminished.
Medical providers are equally thrilled at the Washakie Medical Center in Worland, where they have an advanced system that the hospitals in Wheatland and Torrington will soon be getting. Nan Sutherland oversees some of the electronic medicine efforts in Worland. She says they can use the technology to cross-check to make sure they're treating patients properly.
We can pull information out and monitor and track the quality and level of care that our patients are receiving and be certain that the care that we are providing is timely and is lining up with evidence-based best practices.
This technology also can keep patients from having to be transferred to a larger hospital's intensive care unit. Banner's Deb Dahl says they have devised a system where specialists can observe patients in intensive care and then, through technology, monitor them.
There are a group of physicians, critical care docs, sitting in Mesa, Arizona, and they are monitoring patients in Worland, Wyoming, at the Washakie facility there. The technology that's linked to the electronic medical record looks for adverse trends and allows the clinicians to intervene before those adverse trends become adverse outcomes.
Dahl says by using two-way communication and technology, they're starting to use this with psychologists, neurologists, and other specialists.
Physician can be talking with the patient, can be talking with the patient's provider or as a team, and work through that assessment, prescribe medication, do all the things that you could do in person, but just do it through the telemedicine tool.
Washakie Medical Center's Chief of Nursing Cheryl Sorensen says this will lead to a savings for everyone.
We are able to care for patients here in their own community where they're nearer their support systems. And then that, of course, decreases cost to the payer that's paying for that patient's hospital care, the cost that the family incur to travel.
Dahl says this could be a game changer for smaller hospitals that are trying to survive but do not have the ability to afford a specialist, and for patients who may be able to get care locally. But Dahl also touts the improved care that telemedicine can provide. She says it is saving and will save lives in the future. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck.
Coming up, Pete and Lynn Simpson take their next show on the road. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Rebecca Martinez.
And I'm Willow Belden. We're joined now by Pete and Lynn Simpson. They're doing a production of the play John Brown's Body, which they'll perform across the state this month. Lynn Simpson says the play is actually an epic poem written by Stephen Vincent Benet about 50 years after the end of the Civil War.
It was the most widely read poem in those decades up to the 1950s. He was like a rock star today. Because we didn't have all of the other, avenues for communication. So poetry was widely read out loud. There were societies that would read it. It was required reading in schools. So Margaret Mitchell, who wrote Gone with the Wind, I am sure has read this poem, because as we do the play, which is an adaptation of a 500-page poem, we see and hear in our minds images of the movie Gone with the Wind. I swear that when our audiences listen to us read, they're going to have image after image out of that great classic, Gone with the Wind.
Let me add something here, particularly when you say read. It is reader's theater, but we don't stand and read throughout the play. It is not like a recitation.
No, and we are accompanied in each town that we're touring, Willow, by a 16 to 18 voice chorus. So this reading of this great poem is accompanied by music and some effects.
In fact, the chorus is like a sixth actor. It makes the sound of running feet or marching or children laughing or bugle calls, as well as singing very beautiful songs, very nice and soft and beautiful backup music. So they are acting right along with us. And I don't think there'll be trouble in staying awake. If we do it right.
No, I have a gun. I'm going to shoot it off every time I see someone going to sleep.
But they need to know
Come on,
that
Pete.
It won't be a rock concert skyrocket, but very exciting.
Why do the play now? I mean, obviously this is a play that took place in the Civil War, or a poem really that took place in the Civil War. What makes it relevant to today's audience?
Well, we thought that it would be timely for a lot of reasons. This is a divisive time politically in this country. This Civil War, of course, was the most fundamentally divisive time in our nation's history, and we survived. So to be reminiscent of the character that allowed America to survive even a, as harsh and violent a division as that, it seemed to be for all of us timely. Also, this is the sesquicentennial. I've been rehearsing that phrase. It's the 150th year of the Civil War, and it's being celebrated throughout the country with commemorative events. And then
– then the reason that when I asked – I was asked by a very intelligent person in Wyoming, why should Wyoming care about the Civil War? After I picked myself up out of the chair, I said, because we're Americans. The Civil War is a part of our American history. We're celebrating one of the greatest things ever done by any country in the history of the world, which is free slaves. And we stayed a union. I mean, these things, I think, are important to all Americans.
Let me add one that's very personal. This is the first time that all of our family, all three children, will be involved on the stage with us. We have done theatrical events with all of them. In fact, all five of us together represent about 250 years of theatrical time on the stage. And they all are in the theater or in show business one way or another. So what they have said, they insisted to, this is high time. What I think they were really saying was, before it's too late.
Now, we have that look these days.
feeling our pulse.
Well, this gives us an opportunity to rehearse at long distance. And we think this is a wonderful, exciting experience for people who love language, who love history, who love anything that's beautiful in a theater, and hopefully they'll celebrate our last performance as a family. Pete and I think we should hang it up after this one. The children think we should hang it up, so they're on board to do this tour with us, and it's a very exciting and loving time in our lives.
So doing a play where your whole family is in it, I can imagine that could get a little stressful at times. How do you guys, not come to blows during rehearsals?
We don't. And it is amazing because we did come to blows all the rest of our lives. No, yeah. No, I'm kidding. I think it's that.
One reason is we're separated by thousands of miles.
And they can't get us.
They can't get at us.
I think that we're all interested in doing a beautiful rendition of this poem. And when you're all have the same goal, there's no time for anything but helping each other. And we don't believe in the director. We believe in coaching. So because our children are more experienced and more learned than we are, we just share the coaching. We get on the phone or we get on Skype and we read to each other. And then at the end of it, we say, okay, what do we do? What's better? How can we improve this? And we are all excited. We just love being coaches for one another.
Pete and Lynn Simpson, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for wanting us to be here.
Thank you, Will.
John Brown's Body will be performed in Cody on November 13th, in Casper on the 14th, in Cheyenne on November 15th, and in Laramie on the 16th.
Now, Lori Howe reads her poem, Old Carbon, Wyoming.
Etruscans might have built this place. Its remains a shadow caught under eaves, burned in the fire that inhaled the whole town. Smooth golden stones stack skyward, the thorned hands of the plains holding them up. In the washes, antelope bones lay themselves out across the sand-strewn beds like porcelain bowls and knobs patterned with sage. Veined with roads, the plains gleam with trinkets and shards left behind. What is left here is good only for silence or for those whose words are meant wholly for God.
That was Old Carbon, Wyoming by poet Lori Howe. Thanks for listening to this edition of Open Spaces. If you'd like to hear the entire show or a segment again, you can go to our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. If you have stories or ideas for future shows, you can also pitch them through that website. Tara Orr is our web editor.
We also feature a number of our stories on our Facebook page. If you'd like to become a fan, it's called Wyoming Public Radio News. For daily interactions, story updates, and occasional useless information, our entire news team is on Twitter. I'm at Willow Belden. Rebecca Martinez is at Martinez RL. Bob Beck can be found under the name Butter Bob.
Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.